A Contra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. Welcome, curious listeners, to a deep dive into the truly unique and, well, profoundly hilarious mind of a legendary figure, Woody Allen. Today, we're not just exploring his comedic world, we're really analyzing his collected prose, trying to uncover how his wit offers this surprising defense of sanity in what often feels like a pretty absurd world.
That's a great way to put it. And yeah, when we talk about his collected prose, some people might immediately jump to The Insanity Defense, which is, you know, a famous short story he wrote.
Right, it's in one of the collections.
Exactly. But we're looking bigger picture here at the whole rich tapestry of his work. These classic compilations like Getting Even, Without Feathers, and Side Effects.
Yeah.
And these aren't just like standalone funny stories. They feel more like a comedic manifesto, almost a guide to navigating, well, modern life.
And what makes this so relevant today? I mean, you might be asking that. In a world that feels, let's face it, increasingly complex, often irrational.
Sometimes just overwhelming.
Totally. Allen's insights give us this really distinct lens. They help us look closely at our own anxieties, our relationships, even the institutions we live under. So this deep dive, it's really a shortcut maybe to understanding a fundamental truth. That humor, often when you least expect it, can be the most rational response. A powerful one, even to an irrational world.
It's not just coping, is it? It's almost a form of critical analysis itself.
Exactly. So let's start by talking a bit about the man behind the prose. Woody Allen, born Allen Stewart Konigsberg back in 1935. He's a truly multifaceted American talent.
Cool. Absolutely. Filmmaker, writer, actor, comedian.
Jazz musician, too.
Yeah.
His career spans, what, over six decades now? And there's this incredibly singular, consistent voice throughout.
And it's interesting how his early experiences really sharpened that distinctive perspective. You know, he started out as a gag writer for TV.
Right, and stand-up comedy.
Yeah, stand-up too. And that kind of work forces you to observe life's absurdities with, like, laser precision and distill complex ideas into really sharp jokes.
It's true.
Plus, there's his very well-documented decades-long engagement with psychoanalysis that gives him this almost insider's view of psychological frameworks.
Which he then brilliantly satirizes.
Brilliantly dissects and satirizes, yeah, with remarkable skill.
This really leads into his iconic persona, doesn't it? This neurotic, hyper-intellectual, perpetually anxious New York schlemiel.
That's the one. A schlemiel being, you know, that Yiddish term for someone clumsy, awkward, maybe unlucky.
Right. And what's so fascinating is the duality. He's obsessed with high culture, Freud, Kierkegaard, Bergman films.
Loves Ingmar Bergman.
But at the same time, he's completely preoccupied with mundane stuff. Is my laundry done? Is my love life a mess? Can I find a decent pastrami sandwich?
Chuckles lightly. It's that mix, isn't it? Highbrow intellectualism and just everyday neurosis. That gives his writing its voice. It's so influential, so relatable.
And he's not just making fun of the intellectual world from the outside. He's in it. An active, albeit anxious, participant.
Absolutely. So if we connect that back to his collected prose, what you get is really a masterclass. Literary parody, surreal humor, philosophical satire. It's all in there.
It's not like one long story, though. It's an anthology, right? Short pieces.
Exactly. Essays, one-act plays, even mock academic papers. Each one is carefully crafted to explore his comedic worldview. And the point isn't just laughs, though there are plenty.
No, it's deeper.
It is. It's to provoke thought, to kind of dismantle and expose the often absurd conventions behind serious intellectual stuff, serious literary forms.
So you might be wondering, okay, what's the main argument here? But it's not really a simple thesis, is it?
No, not like you'd find in a straightforward essay. It's more like a sustained comedic exploration of all those modern intellectual anxieties that kind of gnaw at us.
He keeps asking that question. How does a thinking, feeling person navigate a universe that seems, well, meaningless sometimes?
Filled with cosmic dread, intellectual pretension, and yet those incredibly annoying everyday frustrations.
So what's his answer?
Well, his answer, I think, boiled down, is kind of embrace the chaos, parody the whole search for ultimate meaning, and, crucially, find the humor in how spectacularly human reason fails to conquer it all.
That's a key insight, isn't it? That high thought and petty anxieties aren't separate.
Not at all. They're often two sides of the same comically distorted coin. So if you appreciate sharp wit, clever wordplay, seeing pretension get deflated.
This stuff is for you.
Definitely. It's not just entertaining. It's genuinely enlightening.
Okay, let's really get into it then with some specific examples. Because these collections, they're just packed. To really see how his style and themes developed, we should look at some key pieces from the major books.
Absolutely. Let's start with Getting Even. Came out in 1971. You can really feel that direct, almost aggressive parody style right away.
Yeah.
And one piece that just nails it is the Maeterlinck lists. It's this brilliant send-up of, you know, overly serious academic literary analysis.
Oh, I love that one.
It's hilarious. He imagines these mundane laundry lists, supposedly left by some fictional German poet, and then has this pompous scholar dissecting them, finding incredibly overwrought intellectual significance in, like, three undershirts or socks dark.
Chuckles. It perfectly skewers that academic tendency to find deep meaning in, well, anything.
Exactly. It makes you question how much of that is real substance versus just the performance of being intellectual.
And from that same collection, Getting Even, there's a look at organized crime, which just takes the whole gangster mystique and has so much fun with it.
Oh, yeah. He reimagines the mafia as just another modern, totally bureaucratic corporation.
Complete with memos about rubouts.
Memos about rubouts, expense accounts for cement blocks. It's genius. It completely deflates the menace, the seriousness of organized crime with just the ordinary, banal annoyances of corporate life.
It shows how even something terrifying can seem ridiculous through that lens.
Totally. Okay, so moving on to Without Feathers, 1975. This one's often seen as his prose masterpiece. It goes deeper, more existential, more philosophical themes.
And it includes the story that shares the title of our deep dive, right? The Insanity Defense.
That's the one. It's structured like a formal legal and psych case file about this guy named Flossmoor, who has a messiah complex, thinks he's destined to be a savior.
Mm-hmm.
And he's on trial for some bizarre crime. And the story just perfectly parodies legal jargon, psychiatric diagnoses. And subtly but powerfully, it questions that blurry line between fervent faith and, you know, madness.
It really challenges those neat little boxes of sane and insane.
It really does. And then also in Without Feathers, you get something even more fantastical, more thought-provoking, the Kugelmass episode.
Which won an O. Henry Award, didn't it?
It did. It's about Sidney Kugelmass, this bored humanities professor. He finds a magical cabinet that lets him literally enter the world of Flaubert's Madame Bovary.
Wow.
Yeah. He starts an affair with Emma Bovary herself, but then his own deep-seated neurotic personality just completely messes everything up, ruins the fantasy, causes chaos in literary history.
Oh, no.
It's hilarious, but also really insightful about escapism, you know, and that collision between art and life, how our own messy neuroses can just demolish our most cherished fantasies.
What happens when messy reality tries to crash idealized fiction?
Exactly. Then finally, let's jump to Side Effects from 1980. Here, Alan feels maybe his most polished. The pieces are often more narrative, more character-driven.
Like The Whore of Mensa. That title alone.
Right. It's a pitch-perfect, hard-boiled detective story, a total parody, but also a loving homage to Raymond Chandler. The PI is investigating this ring of brilliant college girls, but they're illicit service. It's not what you think. They offer deep, stimulating conversations about philosophy and literature for a fee.
Seriously?
Seriously. It's this amazing fusion of high and low culture, and it brilliantly satirizes intellectual insecurity, how even smart talk can become, well, commodified.
Makes you wonder about intellectual posturing today, doesn't it?
Definitely. And one more gem from Side Effects, Remembering Needleman. It's this wonderful spoof of those stuffy academic eulogies.
Mm.
It's for this totally forgotten philosopher, Jasper Needleman. And his one major contribution, the eulogy tells us, was proving that the traditional Judeo-Christian God is not only dead, but is spending the weekend with a dental hygienist in New Jersey.
Oh, my goodness.
It just perfectly, hilariously mocks that insular, often self-important academic world where reputations can hinge on these gloriously absurd pronouncements. Another great example of using absurdity to critique pretension.
Okay, so we've looked at some great examples. After diving into these, what does it all really mean for us? Let's try to pull out some core themes that run through Alan's work, themes that offer insights into our own lives today.
Yeah, there are definitely a few powerful ones that keep popping up. First, I'd say, is this pervasive theme of the absurdity of existence. And alongside that, the sort of artificiality of psychological categories.
How so?
Well, Alan consistently argues, or maybe suggests, that the universe doesn't come with inherent meaning. And what we call sanity or insanity, those are often just arbitrary labels, socially constructed.
Based on convenience, maybe.
Often, yeah. Social convenience, cultural norms. The insight is that what gets labeled A disorder might depend more on context than on objective science. It really pushes you to question those labels we use.
Which connects to his main character type, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The anxious intellectual is a kind of modern hero.
Absolutely. That Schlemiel persona, again. Someone well-read, maybe brilliant, but also socially awkward, often paralyzed by anxiety.
Yeah.
And from that viewpoint, intelligence isn't your salvation. It's actually the source of profound suffering, which is also profoundly comical in his hands.
So the insight for us is maybe that grappling with that inner conflict.
Yeah.
It's not a flaw.
Right. It's deeply human and maybe even sometimes funny when you look at it, right? Just part of being self-aware.
Okay. And then there's that thing you mentioned earlier, the collision of the cosmic and the mundane.
Oh, yeah. That's his signature comedic move, arguably his most reliable one. You get these characters lost in deep philosophical thought about, you know, the meaning of life or the heat death of the universe.
But then suddenly.
Suddenly they're worried about a loose button on their shirt or creased pants or just desperately needing a good sandwich. It's hilarious, but also humbling. Our big thoughts always run up against our small everyday needs.
Keeps us grounded, I guess.
In a way, yeah. And this leads to another key technique, parody of form as a tool for critique. He doesn't just mock ideas, he mocks the way ideas are presented.
Like the academic paper format and Maeterlinck lists?
Exactly. Or memoirs or philosophical arguments. He perfectly copies the style, the structure, but fills it with absurd content. It's not just funny, it exposes the pretension baked into the form itself.
It's like a meta-commentary.
Totally. It shows that how we talk about big ideas can be just as absurd as the ideas themselves sometimes.
And finally, there's a theme that feels really relevant right now. The commodification of mental health.
Mm-hmm. He subtly critiques how psychological distress has become, well, an industry. Therapy, self-help books, pharmaceuticals.
They're everywhere.
Right. And he raises that question. Are these solutions truly resolving issues, or are they sometimes just maintaining them, creating this endless cycle of treatment?
It makes you think, if everyone suddenly got better, would that actually threaten a lot of businesses?
It's a provocative thought. So taken together, these themes suggest something interesting. Maybe life's lack of meaning isn't just tragic. Maybe it's also a kind of cosmic joke.
And maybe our anxious reactions aren't so irrational after all.
Maybe they're actually quite appropriate, yeah.
His writing is just packed with memorable lines, too, isn't it? Lines that perfectly capture that blend of wit and philosophy. We should share a few that really stick with you.
Definitely. There are so many good ones.
Okay, this first one, it's just brilliant. So simple, so profound. Not only is there no God, but try getting a plumber on weekends.
Chuckles classic.
It perfectly captures that collision, right? Cosmic anxiety, a godless universe. Mm-hmm. Smashed right up against the most mundane, frustrating, everyday problem.
It grounds the profound in the trivial and highlights how our immediate little problems often feel way more urgent than the big questions.
So true. And then there's this one where he skewers philosophical skepticism.
Mm-hmm.
What if everything is an illusion and nothing exists? In that case, I definitely overpaid for my carpet.
I love that. He takes this huge, mind-bending metaphysical problem, is reality real, and instantly processes it through, like, petty personal finance.
It's a great reminder of our persistent, neurotic, everyday concerns.
Yeah.
Even when faced with, you know, the void.
We just can't help ourselves.
And this next one is maybe his most famous, justly celebrated, I'm not afraid of death, I just don't want to be there when it happens.
Ah, yes. Masterful verbal misdirection. It expresses that universal human wish, doesn't it? To somehow avoid the direct personal experience of dying.
It's like this sophisticated understanding of denial mixed with this childishly logical but totally impossible desire.
It's profound and silly all at once.
Exactly. These aren't just jokes. They're incredibly sharp observations about being human, delivered with this amazing comedic timing.
Few can match it.
So, okay, Alan's work doesn't give you a step-by-step how-to guide for life, but it absolutely gives you a powerful how-to-think toolkit.
Mm-hmm.
Like one practical application is just fostering intellectual humility and critical thinking. His satire makes you skeptical of jargon, of authority figures just sounding important.
Right. So in your work life or in academic settings, it encourages you to cut through the buzzwords, focus on the actual substance, not just impressive words or titles.
And what about using an ironic perspective as a coping mechanism? Can that actually work?
I think it can. I mean, life is full of anxieties, disappointments, absurd situations. Alan teaches us to see the humor in that gap, the gap between our expectations and reality, our big plans and our clumsy actions.
Laughing at the absurdity.
Yeah. Learning to laugh at those mismatches can build real resilience. If you can see a problem as fundamentally absurd, that's maybe the first step toward not letting it crush you.
That makes sense. It also seems like his work encourages us to question distress, maybe, instead of just immediately internalizing it.
How do I mean?
Well, instead of automatically thinking, oh, I'm anxious, there's something wrong with me, his work nudges you to consider, is this anxiety maybe an appropriate reaction to genuinely difficult circumstances?
Like city stress or a dehumanizing job.
Exactly. It reframes it. Maybe the struggle isn't just your pathology. Maybe it points to a problem in the environment or the system.
That's a really valuable shift in perspective. Less self-blame.
Yeah. And finally, there's this sense of consolation in shared neurosis. That feels really powerful.
Mm-hmm. Alan gives voice to all those universal, often unspoken anxieties we carry around. Fear of death, social awkwardness, feeling intellectually insecure.
Things we don't usually talk about.
Right. And by making them the subject of brilliant comedy, he normalizes them. It creates this feeling of shared humanity, like, okay, it's not just me.
You're not alone in your quiet panic.
Exactly. There's real comfort in that.
So wrapping up, for me, the biggest takeaway from this deep dive is that humor isn't just, you know, a distraction from life's serious stuff. It's actually one of the sharpest tools we have for analyzing it, for understanding it.
Mm.
Alan's work offers this profound shift. It shows how the biggest philosophical questions and our most intense personal anxieties, they aren't separate things. They're deeply and often comically tangled together.
Yeah, what really stands out for me is that liberating perspective he gives us on our own fears and failings, our human follies. Woody Allen reminds us that our struggle for meaning in this chaotic universe, It's noble, sure, often tragic.
Yeah.
But it's also, if you just tilt your head and look at it from the right angle, incredibly funny.
See you next time. With another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.